This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. In Detroit Tuesday, two gunmen sprayed gunfire on a group of people at a bus stop in broad daylight. Bullets hit seven students, ages ranging from 14 to 17. Thankfully, none of the wounds are life-threatening. A business owner near that bus stop described the area as a place where hopelessness is common. For many of us, that kind of violence is something we read about in the newspaper, but in too many communities across the country, there is a bus stop like that, a 7-Eleven where the owner was murdered, a corner where a woman was attacked, places where the aura of past violence hangs like a shroud. Sometimes it's a community shocked by a rare example of violence. Sometimes it's a place that deals with it on a too often regular basis. Everywhere it happens, the ripple effect touches everyone. Later in this hour, NPR's ombudsman on the use of the word torture, but first, living with violence. If that's a murder or an assault in your neighborhood, your town, tell us what surprised you about your reaction, about how it affected the places and the people around you. Our phone number is 800-989-8255. Email us, talk@npr.org. You can also join the conversation on our website. That's at npr.org. Click on Talk of the Nation. Martha Thomas is a reporter for the Urbanite magazine in Baltimore. She wrote an article for called The Departed about a shooting there and joins us here in Studio 3A. Nice to have you on Talk of the Nation today.
Thanks so much.
And Martha, tell us what happened to Delvon Rashad Butts.
Well, Delvon was apparently on his way home in early October. It was about 9:30 at night on a Monday evening. And he was shot twice in the back, and he was rushed to intensive care, and he died about 2 weeks later.
This was a 15-year-old kid on his bicycle.
15-year-old boy on his bicycle.
There was another man nearby who had gotten out of prison just 10 days earlier, but he said, hey, they weren't aiming at me.
That's correct. The theory is that the shots were random. The police don't really have definitive answers to any of the questions, at least last I checked.
And this was last October. It doesn't seem like answers are going to be forthcoming anytime soon. I wonder, what was the effect on Delvon's family?
Well, it's an interesting story because, like so many urban families, they were devastated. But I think there was a certain part of them that was expecting tragedy. They might not have been expecting it to happen to Delvon, but it was a very, very difficult period. And I think the first response, of course, was absolute shock and grief. And then they kind of turned their attention to planning the funeral, to sort of getting that step over with.
And it's interesting. Was he a bad kid? Was he in a gang or anything like that?
There's no evidence that he was in a gang, and there's really no evidence that he was doing something wrong. As I said, the police still have some questions about why he was where he was at the time. But he really, according to his teachers and the principal from his school, whom I spoke with as part of this story, he was a likable kid. He was eager to learn, but he did get in trouble in school. He had been expelled from the school that he attended for a fight that he was in. And then I'm trying to piece it together. He'd been expelled from school. Oh, I know what I was gonna. The family really had so many touching stories about him. He had three little nephews. He has a 25-year-old sister who is 10 years older than he, and she has three little boys, and they tell stories about him playing with his nephews and picking them up after school and being a great help to the family, dancing in the living room. You know, he loved to put on music. And, you know, by all the accounts from the family, he was a very likable, loving child.
And he's not the only kid in his family who's, as you said, they had an expectation of tragedy. Somebody else in his family has also been shot and killed.
Yes, that it was his a cousin of his had been killed 5 years earlier.
And those little boys you talked about, they've now been to the funerals of two of their uncles.
Yes. The mother of the little boys, well, actually one of the boys' father's brother had was killed.
And you have to, their mother has to be concerned about, you know, what are they going to see? What are they going to expect? You describe a neighborhood where so many people told you in your story for The Urbanite, kids don't necessarily expect to live much past 25.
Well, that's a story that we've been hearing for a long time, you know, that there is so much violence on the streets and the expectation is shortened. And I think that one of the things that's happening now is, you know, we're entering like another generation of that. I mean, not only is it Ashley, the mother's generation, losing people her age, but now it's her sons. And the question that I'd like to follow at some point is, where does this grief go?
You also describe his mother, obviously shocked, but even sometime after the murder of her son, trying to find a way to get into a program so she could get an antidepressant.
Yes, she did talk afterwards about long delays and difficulty seeing doctors and not really having the resources. I have a feeling that this family had a difficult time navigating the system. I mean, they had a great deal of support and help from the mother's siblings. In fact, that's how they put the funeral together. They had, they actually got help from the state, from the Victims Compensation Bureau, to pay for the funeral.
Martha Thomas of The Urbanite is telling us the story of what happened after one shooting in an area of Baltimore. What's happened where you live if there's been violence? How are the ripple effects being felt? What surprised you about your response? 800-989-8255. Email us talk@npr.org. And Josh is on the line calling from Sacramento.
My wife and I actually just bought a house in an area that we weren't really all that familiar with. A little over a year ago, and probably 3 weeks ago, I walked my dog down to the park that's just down the street and was playing with him, and we'd been going there for a while, and it was always safe. But that day, I saw one group of youths walking past another group of teenagers, and they looked like they started arguing about something, and I kind of had a feeling it was going to turn out bad, and then a couple of them went to the car and came back and just started shooting at the other kids. So I just grabbed my dog and took off running and came back about 3 minutes later, and there was, you know, a bunch of cops there and other people standing around, but it definitely took me a couple weeks to feel comfortable going back there.
I could understand that. Was anybody hurt, do you know?
Yeah, no, a couple kids got shot and were laying on the ground, and then there was a manhunt that went on in the neighborhood. But this was all, I mean, like I said, it's a new neighborhood to us, and this is all after our house got broken into 3 months after we moved here, so it just kind of adds to a feeling of not really feeling secure or safe in our own neighborhood.
And I'm hearing something in your voice that's a little bit more beyond just nervousness about talking on the radio.
Yeah, no, I mean, we're young. This is our first house. We didn't really, I guess, we didn't really do enough research. And I mean, we love our house. We like some of the neighborhood and some of the aspects of the neighborhood, but it's totally different from where we used to live. And just the feeling of knowing that there's, I mean, violence happens everywhere, and I understand that. But just seeing how, you know, how it instigated over such something so petty. I mean, I don't know what they were arguing about, but they just walked past and someone said something that the other didn't like, and it was like one or two shoves, and then they ran to the car. And it's just, I don't know.
It's pretty scary.
It bode well for the next 30 years of our mortgage. So.
Josh, good luck to you and the neighborhood.
All right. Thank you, Neil.
Thanks very much for calling. Tio Hardiman sees the effects of violent crime firsthand. He's the director of the Gang Mediation and Community Organizing with Ceasefire in Chicago and joins us now from our member station there, WBEZ. Thanks very much for being with us.
It's good to be here, Neil.
And I suspect that story that we just heard from Sacramento is all too familiar.
It happens all the time across major cities, you know, throughout America. And I would like to first of all start by saying Ceasefire is scientifically proven It's a scientifically proven method to help reduce shootings and homicides across the nation, which is backed up by a 3-year evaluation by 4 different universities and backed by the Department of Justice as well. Just want to mention that.
All right. Well, you got the plug in. but when something like that happens,
right.
These events don't go away. It's interesting. We were talking about that other story in Baltimore, and Martha Thomas was showing me the extent of the news coverage that murder received in the local newspaper. And, you know, in that area of Baltimore, it's not news. And it wasn't news either in Chicago until, well, a whole bunch of them happened.
Well, you know, violence has become the norm in a lot of cities across America. And in Chicago, a lot of times people expect violence. That's why you have to hire and employ credible messengers that can go out and reverse this mindset and change hearts and minds and change the norm, because a lot of people just think it's okay. As a matter of fact,
We're getting the message. You have a program.
Okay.
You think it works. You're proud of it.
No.
Thank you
no,
for that. We're trying to get an idea of what this feels like for people who live in the area.
Well, that's what I'm about to tell you now. Yesterday, I spent about 4 hours with a 14-year-old kid from the Inglewood community. He lives on the block where a 13-year-old girl was just killed last week. And this young man, he was enrolled in summer school. Now he won't go to school, and he feels pretty bad about everything that's going on in the community. He can't sleep at night. So the whole community has been traumatized because of these acts of violence, and it's going on time and time again. In some kind of way, we have to get in there and really change the way people think about violence. I was at a lounge about 4 or 5 years ago, and they were searching people. One guy came into the lounge. He didn't want nobody to search him. He had a gun on him, okay? He said, "Can't nobody search me?" And he pulled the gun out and held it up in the air. And next you know, everybody in the lounge looked at the guy like he was crazy. "Don't pull no gun out in here." And he stepped out the lounge and put the gun up after that incident. That's very important, because we have to change the way people think, because nobody's really challenging the violence. Everybody, they're expecting violence in the whole community. You have kids, like in Baltimore, they say 70% of the students don't even graduate out of high school because of the violence.
We'll talk more with T.O. Hardiman, the director of the Gang Mediation and Community Organizing with Ceasefire from Chicago. And our thanks to Martha Thomas, a writer in the Baltimore magazine, The Urbanite. Nice of you to join us today.
Thank you.
800-989-8255. Email us talk@npr.org. What surprised you about your reaction when there's been violence in your town or your neighborhood? What's been the effect as the ripples spread around? Stay with us. I'm Neil Conan. It's the Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Violence changes a community, daily life, and the people who live there. If you've faced a murder or an assault in your neighborhood, in your town, tell us what surprised you about your reaction, about how it affected the places and the people around you. Our phone number, 800-989-8255. Email us talk@npr.org. You can also join the conversation on our website. That's at npr.org. Click on Talk of the Nation. Our guest is T.O. Hardiman, who directs Gang Mediation and Community Organizing with Ceasefire, a group in Chicago. And let's see if we can get another caller on the line. And we'll go to Mike. Mike's on the line with us from Philly.
Yeah, hey, T.O. Hey, Neil. How's it going?
All right.
How you doing?
Hey, listen, I have something to say about Philadelphia's violence. It's out of control. In my neighborhood, there was a shooting about 4 months ago. Somebody made a turn too quick on one of these small one-way streets we got here in the city, and they thought that they almost got hit, and he pulled out a gun. It's just too many of today's youth, particularly black youth in Philadelphia, between the ages of 14 to 25, that are high and also strapped at the same time, walking around daily in our city streets.
And by strapped, you mean carrying a gun.
It's such a problem for me. I've thought about leaving the country in Scandinavia, where they have 300 murders by handguns per year instead of 25,000.
And as you look around the neighborhood, what effect does it have? Because some kids are armed, other kids feel they need to carry a weapon too?
You either have a gun on you because you're dealing drugs, you're in a drug community, or you feel like you need a weapon because everybody else has a weapon. And I don't know where the end is. It seems like it's ad infinitum with this.
All right, Mike, thanks very much for the call. Appreciate it. You, T.O. Hardiman, know better than most how much of this is gang-related. Gangs are community organizations of a strange sort. People know who's in a gang. People know who's doing this. Are people frightened of them? Do people shy away from them? Do people confront them and say, "Why are you doing this?"
Yeah, a lot of times people step up and confront the gangs, but, you know, 70% of the violence is interpersonal violence. People get into petty conflicts, and they just don't know how to work things out and, you know, resolve the issue without violence. What you got going on here, here's another story for you, Neil. There was a kid that came to me about 19 years old about a week and a half ago. He owed about $150 to a, you know, resident, you know, drug dealer, and the drug dealer wanted to take his life for the $150. His friend told me about the story, and then I talked to the drug dealer and talked him down from killing this kid about $150. See, violence is expected amongst people. This wasn't a gang situation, but this is more like a, you know, interpersonal conflict.
Mm-hmm.
And we've mediated conflicts like that about 120 times already this year. But at the same time, it goes on and on. There's another quick story, Neil. There was a young girl. She's 8 years old here in Chicago on the south side of Chicago. She got a gift from her principal. It was too big for her to carry home. She let her friend carry it home. Her friend took it home with her. The 8-year-old girl was mad about that. She got her 14-year-old brother to confront her friend. And her friend had three brothers who were 17, 18, and 20. They beat her 14-year-old brother up. He called his crazy cousins. Next thing you know, we have a potential gang conflict on the block. Garages got burnt down, and we had to send our violence interrupters in there, the credible messengers, to actually resolve this conflict that started about a gift. It was interpersonal conflict.
Let's get a story on the line. This is Jesus. Jesus with us from Mountain View in California.
Hey, Neil, how's it going?
All right.
Okay, so I grew up in high school. When I was in high school, it was like the early 90s, mid-90s, kind of when the gang stuff was getting really crazy and everybody was trying to emulate the L.A. gang scene and stuff. I grew up in Texas, and we had a bunch of wannabe gangsters in our neighborhood. We got a lot of drive-bys and that kind of thing. My dad kind of kept us on lockdown. It was as soon as it got dark, everybody'd come inside. You couldn't be outside after dark. We put the car in the garage, and there were nights when, you know, we'd hear a gunshot, and we'd have to sleep. We'd all sleep in my sister's room because it faced the backyard. So, like, because most of the bedrooms had windows that faced the street, but he like, nah, everybody go in here. We'd all be asleep on the floor in my sister's room, and it was weird. It was like you're kind of living in a war zone, but you had to adapt to it. I mean, some people talk about, like, moving to the neighborhood, moving out of the country. But most of these people, you can't do any of that. You just got to suck it up and deal with it.
Yeah, they don't have those choices, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. You just deal with it. Other people would join, like, the neighborhood watch thing.
Mm-hmm.
And they would start doing patrols and all that. One guy, it was crazy. His own son was in a gang, and he was in the neighborhood watch. It was really bizarre, you know, seeing that go down for a few years. And, you know, for me, like, the way it's affected me, like, yeah, like, I went to college. I got the heck out of there, and I was like, I don't, you know, I live in the Bay Area now, and I have no interest in living in an urban area. I like the peace and the quiet, and I like going to the city and having a little bit of fun, but it's nerve-wracking. I like silence at night because it's just, I don't, you know, my dad was always like, at night, it was like, put the cars in the garage. We'd even put the cars in the garage, and, you know, before the lights in the house were going out, everybody's going to bed, you know, somebody go lock the front door. You know, we had three deadbolts on the front door. It was always like, lock things up, you know, just be as safe as you can. But, you know, you can't actually get up and move. It was just deal with it how you could there.
I hope you sleep well tonight, Jesus.
Thank you very much.
Bye-bye. It's interesting. He made the analogy to a war zone, and, of course, he's not the first to do that. I spent some time years ago covering the Troubles in Northern Ireland and Belfast when I was there. It's probably more Valium per person than any other place on the planet. How much in a place like Chicago do people use drugs to and prescription or non-prescription, if you will, to ease their minds?
Yeah, a lot of people medicate themselves with drugs. Neil, here in Chicago, the ecstasy pills, the alcohol, a lot of people try to stay numb because they don't want to deal with the realities that are going on around in the neighborhood. You know, so drugs are definitely a big escape for a lot of people, especially a lot of offenders that commit crimes as well. You hear stories about guys that are high out of their minds when they go and shoot somebody. So they end up, you know, participating in drive-by shootings and everything like that. But the bottom line, Neil, what it comes down to, we need to create a national movement around this issue of violence and get the right people out there talking to the right people on the streets and get them to put their guns down. That's what it comes down to. Just Saturday, I attended a ceremony where you had about 10 parents there who had lost their kids to violence. And it was so emotional. I couldn't even speak myself, Neil, because the impact on how it's taken a toll on all these parents. One guy was saying he will never have grandkids because his only kid was killed, you know? Mm. And people need to see this. Some of our ceasefire operatives in the Rosen community on the south side of Chicago just organized a big march with gang members and victims. And we allowed the gang members and victims to talk about the emotional impact on how the violence has taken a toll on their personal lives. Okay?
Here's an email from Shell in Fort Myers in Florida. On May 16th, 2009, a really close friend of mine was killed on the streets of Fort Myers. The saddest part of his gruesome murder, aside from the fact that the murderer has not been found, is the fact that it was accepted as a normal occurrence in Fort Myers. Several months ago, two former high school classmates of mine were gunned down at a party in Fort Myers. I decided to put together a petition for us young people to stand up against violence in our streets. However, I am sad to say I am not able to get anyone to sign my petition. The overall response I receive is this is the norm. It's sad that my children have to grow up in this community and people have given up on doing anything about these crimes.
That's the point I'm making. Violence has become acceptable. It's the norm. And violence spreads just like a disease. And we have to get people in there to disrupt the spreading of the disease. That's why we call the guys violence interrupters and outreach workers, changing norms and values. Because right now, you have two different communities here in America, Neil. You have the underworld community and you have the working class community. And in the underworld community, everybody feels it's okay. And the sad thing about it, a lot of these young men and women across America get caught up in that underworld type of mindset when they don't have to get caught up in it. And then they begin to overlook acts of violence. And then it catches up with people years later because you become desensitized. And we need to resensitize people so we can address this issue as a public health issue, because it's a sickness. It's definitely a sickness.
Ann is on the line with us from Evanston, Illinois.
Oh, hi. Thanks. I wanted to give another point of view to the poor guy who moved into a neighborhood and is looking around and wondering what's going to happen for the next 30 years.
The caller from Sacramento earlier, yeah.
Yes. 25 years ago, I live actually in South Evanston, and Evanston does have a certain level of gang activity and crime. Two of the murders, Evanston doesn't have a lot of murders, but two of them took place a block from my home. And I lived there for many years feeling very frightened and wondering, you know, the same way, move to Europe or whatever. And I've completely changed my whole way of looking at it. I'm actually a minority. I'm white. I'm a minority in the a neighborhood. I got on the neighborhood park board. I've also gotten involved with as many community, like neighborhood watches, which also include the police officers. And Evanston has a community policing approach, which I think is excellent. Because when you hear the police talk about the kids not as this menace, but as like the heartbreaking stories of kids, you know, with no parents at home. And, you know, we're frightened of these 15-year-olds, but they're just as scared and unsupervised, you know, that of course they're going to get into trouble. And I began to look at it as, yes, absolutely, it can't be thought of as the norm. It has to have some active people, and it takes everyone in the neighborhood. I also, for the first number of years that I lived in my neighborhood, I just got in my car and went to work and tried to pretend as if didn't matter,
yeah,
and that I didn't need to be involved.
Yeah, which raises a question, Teo Hardiman. Why is it that some communities seem to bond together and say we have to do something, and some seem to be overwhelmed by the violence?
Yeah, that's a good question, Neil. What happens is a lot of communities feel they're overwhelmed because it just happens so many times. And every time they try to step up, like the caller before this young lady, they talked about signing a petition, and a lot of people didn't participate because you don't get a lot of people stepping up, okay? We have to raise the voices of the faith-based leaders community, raise the voices of the community residents, but a lot of people are scared because they live next door to the shooters. They live next door to the killers. So everybody pretends that the violence is not happening. Okay, that's what happens there. But we've had some successes here in Chicago. We've seen an average of a 16% to 28% reduction in shootings and homicides in some of the communities in which we work in at Ceasefire. And then also we've seen some successes where we had an 83% reduction in some neighborhoods. And when you talk about changing norms, there was a community in the Logan Square area on the northwest side of Chicago. They call it Beat 1413. Well, that beat had about 8 homicides in a 4x12 block radius. And when we started working there, and I'm not just plugging my program there, I just want to let you know that, but I just want to give you some facts. When we started working there, we met with all the gang leaders, we met with everybody. You talk about changing mindsets and norms. They didn't have one homicide the next year, not one, because the groups of people began to believe in what we were talking about and all the help we were trying to provide and guidance we were providing to them. But the community rallied around their community as well. And that's what it comes down to. We have to get out there all the time and raise awareness. We have to. You can't get around it.
And thanks very much for the call. And
you're welcome. And I totally wholeheartedly agree with what your guests are advocating.
T.O. Hardiman is our guest. He's director of gang mediation and community organizing with Ceasefire in Chicago. 800-989-8255. Email talk at npr.org. You're listening to Talk of the Nation, coming to you from NPR News. Let's go next to Caressa. Caressa with us from Cincinnati.
Hi, I'm an in-home therapist. I work with adolescents, males predominantly, who have dual diagnosis of substance abuse and some kind of mental illness. So most of my clients come from some of the worst neighborhoods in Cincinnati and stuff. And I had done a home visit one day. I was opening this client, and I got to the apartment complex, and it was a fair day. You would expect everybody to be out on the street, and it was just... it was like a zombie town. There was no one to be seen except for 7 men that were at an SUV on the curb. And I just knew something was not right. So I ended up going home that day. And the next day, to just try to understand my client's worlds better, I started talking to one of the mothers of my client. And I had described my experience. And she had told me, she says, well, that was probably because everyone in the community knew that there was something that was going to go down. And so I investigated a little bit more, and she ended up disclosing to me that there's so much violence in some of our neighborhoods and so many shootings that the parents kind of have, your guest was talking about this underground world, they kind of have this underground system of letting each other know when somebody has some discord going on and to keep your children inside and just... to speak of the ripple effect, I'm on my way to a client's house now, and I caught myself thinking a couple minutes ago that I'm almost kind of happy that perhaps some of my families probably will not listen to this program, because I choose to live in an urban setting because I want my children to have a cultural experience and to be open-minded. But along with that, I also have to teach them how to combat some of this violence that they're going to face. And it's just kind of scary.
It is. It is scary, Caressa. And that's one of the things I wanted to ask T.O. Hardiman about. People get scared. People react, as you said, T.O. They get numb to it. They get desensitized. How do you sustain your outrage?
Well, you sustain your outrage because what happens that it all goes back to credible messages, people that have backbone, that are willing to stand up to the guys that are out there perpetrating acts of violence on everybody and making sense out of the madness and bringing people around. Let me tell you another story, because you want to hear some stories out here, because we do this every day. There was a young man that wanted to shoot some other guys because somebody shot his car windows out. I sent one of my violence interrupters over to the scene to talk to the guys and get them to put their guns down. The one guy started crying in the middle of the street. And the violence interrupter had to console this young man and hold him in his arms and let him know it's okay not to shoot, man. It's okay not to pull your gun out. You don't know who shot your windows out. You were not in the car. We'll go there and talk to the guys and get them to pay for your windows. A situation like that could have erupted. A few people could have got shot, but we were able to reverse the thinking on location. That's what it comes down. Then you take that one situation and then you begin to respond to all the shootings in the community, because it's very important just to increase the awareness, number one. And number two, let people know it's not normal to shoot people. It's just not normal.
It's just not normal. Here's an email from Tony in Waltham, Massachusetts. My students tell me they are afraid to take jobs that let out at night or to put a hood up where it rains for fear of violence. Students call me from colleges where they are on scholarship to tell me they can't study because they've been so traumatized by the death of cousins and friends back home. They are haunted by the senselessness of these deaths, worry about being away from home, worried about coming back, the stress is enormous. And those effects, they don't go away to you, do they?
No, they linger on for years and years. This young lady that lost her daughter 2 years ago, she can't even hardly stand up because it's just so hard for her to bear with the fact that she'll never see her daughter again. It's rough, but that's the reason why. Think about the civil rights era when the community had to organize together for the common purpose of progressing for, you know, what was right here in America. Right now, violence in Chicago across our nation is a humanitarian crisis, and we need to galvanize the same support and the same spirit and really work out here in these communities in a major way.
T.O., thanks very much for your time today. We appreciate it.
Thank you very much, Neil.
T.O. Hardiman, director of the Gang Mediation and Community Organizing with Ceasefire. He joined us from our member station in Chicago, WBEZ.